so we are picking up here in chapter 18 of Judges. And we kind of got about halfway through this chapter, so we're going to pick up where we left off. Chapter 17 through 21 really serve as an epilogue for the book of Judges. And really, it just serves to highlight the spiritual confusion and the depravity in Israel during this time. Now, though the accounts that we'll see through in chapter 17 through 21, through the end of the book, even though that's at the end of the book, the internal evidence that we see through these accounts, they do tend to point to these events actually happening relatively early on during the period of Judges. So just because they're at the end of the book, don't make the assumption to think that these are like late on during the period of Judges. That's not really the case. And the point there is that it doesn't take long for things to unravel when you deviate from God's word. It doesn't take long at all. The theme that we see throughout the book of Judges is disobedience. The message being that sin, disobedience, it has consequences. And we see it time and time again. Often in this life, that's true, but also that applies more so with the afterlife, with what comes next, because our sin separates us from God. The cycle of sin that we've seen over and over again throughout the book of Judges, it is a great portrayal of the struggle humanity has had since the fall. It's the same issue that we've always struggled with. It paints a very clear picture for us for exactly why Jesus Christ's sacrifice on the cross for us was necessary. Despite Israel and humanity's shortcomings, we see that God still loves us. He still wants to be united with us. So much so that he sent deliverers, judges, to save his people time and time again. Now, for Israel, these were just mere men. They were flawed but courageous men. But they were more than just who they were. They also pointed the way to something greater that was to come. The judges that we see throughout the book of Judges, they point the way to the Messiah, to Christ, to Jesus, the Son of God. Because at a certain point that will come, and we see this fulfilled in the New Testament, that God sends one final judge. He sends Jesus, the perfect deliverer, the perfect judge, to save mankind once and for all. So we're picking up here in verse 22 here of chapter 18. And it says, "And when they had gone some distance from Micah's house, the men who lived near Micah were called together and overtook the Danites. And as they shouted after them, the Danites turned and said to Micah, 'What's the matter with you that you called out your men to fight?' He replied, 'You took the gods I made and my priest and went away. What else do I have? How can you ask what's the matter with you?' And the Danites answered, 'Don't argue with us, or some of the men might get angry and attack you, and you and your family will lose your lives.' And so the Danites went their way, and Micah, seeing that they were too strong for him, turned around and went back home. And then they took what Micah had made and his priests, and they went on to Laish against a people at peace and secure. They attacked them with the sword and burned down their city. There was no one to rescue them because they lived a long way from Sidon and had no relationship with anyone else. And the city was in a valley near Beth Rehob. And the Danites rebuilt the city and settled there. And they named it Dan after their ancestor Dan, who was born to Israel, though the city used to be called Laish." We see here that Micah loses everything. And remember, earlier on, when he had hired this priest, this Levite, to come live with him, to be his father, in quotes there, he had rationalized to himself that God would do well with him, that things were going to be all right with him because he had this guy in his home. That's not the case. Micah loses everything here. This priest was a charlatan. These people are not righteous. They are greedy and self-serving. And it's important that we remember that the book of Judges, it's filled with cautionary tales. It's not filled with examples for us to follow. It's filled for us to things to avoid, paths not to take. And we see here that this city that the Danites do conquer and they claim for their own, there's a lesson there that isolation makes us weak. They were a people set off to themselves, that they didn't have any connections, any kind of ties, any kind of alliances. They were too far away from the people that they had come from for them to get any aid in a time of war or time of stress. And this is true for us today. As Christians, we are stronger when we are together. We need to make sure that we don't try to isolate ourselves off. Lessons that we can take away from this. You know, when service is over, don't rush out the door. Stick around a while. Talk to people, socialize, build relationships with your fellow brothers or sisters. Make it a habit to talk to other members of the church when you're not here. You know, sometimes we treat each other really friendly when we come here, and then we know we don't talk until we meet again, right? The problem is that that's not really building a strong relationship with one another. That's not going to be a friend that you're going to feel comfortable talking to or calling when you're really in dire need if the only time you talk to them is here at the building on Sundays and Wednesdays. So don't fall into that trap, because the devil wants you to be isolated. He wants you to think you got this on your own. None of us do. We need each other. That's why God gave us this family, because we're a support group for each other. And that's a lesson that we can take from these people and the fate that they suffered from. And that's the message we see in Ecclesiastes 4:9, where it talks about how two are stronger than one, and a cord of three is you know, hard to break. That's the idea there. In verses 30 here, let's see how this concludes. It says in verse 30, it says, "There the Danites set up for themselves the idol, and Jonathan, son of Gershom, son of Moses, and his sons were priests for the tribe of Dan until the time of the captivity of the land. They continued to use the idol of Micah had made all the time the house of God was in Shiloh," house of God being the tabernacle. Now, there's those verses are kind of controversial, and we'll break this down and talk about this for a moment. The Danites here, they worshiped this idol for as long as the tabernacles in Shiloh. We're talking about a time period of 200 to 300 years that they just decide to worship God the way they want to. They're going to follow the priests that they set up. They're going to do it at the altar that they made for themselves. Last week, we had looked at verses, chapters in Deuteronomy that actually talked about that they weren't supposed to do that. They were supposed to go to specific places to worship, to do their offerings. They weren't to just do it wherever they chose to do it. But we see here that the Danites, they're ignoring that. They set up their own altar. They established their own priests. They do this until the time of captivity. And this is in direct violation of God's word, but the people didn't care. They were worshiping God the way they wanted to, what seemed right to them. And unfortunately, when you do that, you're not worshiping God at all. You're worshiping yourself. You're doing what seems right to you. Another thing here is, and this it's important we don't overlook this, who was the young Levite priest in this account? The one that we see in chapter 17 and chapter 18. Remember, this account is written years and years after it happens. This wasn't written contemporary to these events. So you do have a sense that the writer saves a reveal for the end. And who is this Levite priest, this young Levite that takes a position in Micah's house as a personal priest, that blesses the Danite spies on their quest to search for a different land inheritance than what God had actually provided, that had betrayed Micah when a better offer presented itself with the tribe of Dan, that had helped the Danites steal and then later worship Micah's idols? It was Jonathan, son of Gershom, the son of Moses. So this is the grandchild of Moses. And we see over in Exodus 2 that Moses and Zipporah, their firstborn, was Gershom. Now, depending on the translation you read from, yours might say son of Moses, or it might say son of Manasseh. So it depends. If you're reading from the NASB, or if you're reading from the New King James or the King James, it will say son of Manasseh there. But the ESV, the NIV, the ASV, they say son of Moses. The reason for that is, out of the ancient manuscripts we have of this text, many of them say son of Moses, and many of them say son of Manasseh. The difference in that word in Hebrew is one letter. And so when I was studying for this class, I did a little research on this. It certainly could have been the son of Moses, because we will see here in Judges 20 that some of these accounts are actually contemporary with Phinehas. So it would make sense that as far as the time frame goes. But you'll notice if you do any studying in 1 Chronicles that Jonathan, a person named Jonathan being the son of Gershom, is not included in the genealogy of Moses. Instead, a name Shubael is included there as Moses' son. The problem with that, though, is Shubael is contemporary with the time of David. So it doesn't make sense either. We'll see that over in 1 Chronicles 26. The reason why some say Manasseh and some say Moses is because there is a huge debate among Jewish scribes and scholars as to whose name belongs in the text here. The reason being, and this is actually recorded even in ancient documents of Jewish scribes, that they did not want to say the son of Moses because it gave Moses a black eye. It impugned his name. Someone that they revered as being right up there with people. I mean, the law of Moses. They looked up to Moses in a way that in some ways you could say is unhealthy, because they put him up on a pedestal so much that ancient scribes and scholars didn't want him associated with wicked evil deeds. But here's, and you'll see this, in the Talmud, for instance, it acknowledges that the ancient text actually said son of Moses, but that he did the deeds of Manasseh. And so these ideas kind of got conjoined as scribes would copy the text over and over again. That's why we have copies that say both. And, you know, King Manasseh was an evil king. We see his accounts over in 2 Kings chapter 21. In the Targum, which was ancient Jewish text that would have been read to the people, there were times that actually were recorded where they knew it said son of Moses, but they would read son of Manasseh out loud to the people. And again, there's this idea that they didn't want to make Moses look bad. So it was easier to attribute this person to just a son of Manasseh. The problem is, first off, so what if it makes Moses look bad? That's not a reason to try to conceal what the Bible actually says. And it's an important thing we need to be mindful of. The Bible doesn't paint Moses as a perfect figure. He was a murderer. He killed an Egyptian and buried his body so he wouldn't be found. He had a temper problem. There are plenty of flaws that Moses had as a person. But even if that were true, even if you wanted to say, you know, well, it doesn't matter about Moses, we're not talking about Moses. We're talking about his grandson. It doesn't make Moses look bad to acknowledge what his children's children would have done, no more than it does us. Because we're not accountable for what our children's children do. We're accountable for what we do and how we live. And God makes that clear even in Ezekiel. So that this idea that they need to be people trying to cover up truth because we want to keep people having like a certain status or a certain look, that's shameful, and that ought not to be the case. And so you'll see there's debates among scholars and scribes about which way you should read this. And there's different evidences that point to different ones. But I'll tell you that even in the Jewish writings that say this is why it should be the son of Manasseh, that's not a legitimate reason. That by itself, because we don't just change the word of God because we want to make it sound nicer. That's inappropriate. It is shameful to see Moses' descendants do these kind of things, to act wickedly. But that's the point. The book of Judges is a book of shame. It's a book of seeing people do terrible things. It's seeing people in really not their finest moments. Even the people that God chooses to work through throughout the book of Judges, they are flawed people. They are flawed people. The moral of the story is that nobody is beyond falling away. That no one should be put up on a pedestal. We can all fall. We can all fall short. We all do. Sin is always waiting at the door. And that's true for all of us. There's no one here above it. And, you know, and it wants to conquer us, and it will if we let it. It goes back to what God told Cain when Cain had a bad attitude about a sacrifice, way back in Genesis 4:7. Sin wants to conquer you. It wants to take you, but you have to control it. You have to not let it do that. So it's important that we keep that in mind. But anyway, depending on your translation, it might say one or the other. But when I did research on this, the arguments for the son of Manasseh felt very weak to me, because a lot of it had to do with appearances and about protecting the lineage of Moses. And I find that to be lacking in what we should believe and how we should believe it. But that's why the ancient manuscripts are kind of divided on this, because we do have more than one copy. So when to me, that's a testament to God's word, that he preserves enough of truth that we can actually even have that discussion. That man, even in their attempts, they weren't able to cover up what God actually had wrote down. So, in case you were wondering, that's why. But here we see this. And again, because this story was written years later, this is almost provides a aha moment or a gotcha or a reveal at the end, that this young Levite that we see throughout this account, that it was someone that should have known better. That should have came from a family that was better than this. And that's, again, it shows that we all fall, that no one's perfect, that no one's beyond reproach. In chapter 19 here, we're moving on here, it says, in these days Israel had no king. And now a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And really quick, we know we don't have concubines in our society today, so I'll address this. A concubine was a second-class wife. It wasn't a good practice. It wasn't something that you should do, but it was commonly accepted, especially in the ancient world, to do this. It was a wife that was used for sexual pleasure. They really weren't in charge of the house. They weren't. Their job was not to be the matriarch or to run the household the way you would typically see a wife to do. They were there for the pleasure of the husband. While you know, but there were some benefits to being a concubine. It wasn't a mistress. That would be a third person. A concubine did have some benefits, and that was that if the first wife couldn't have children, or if the first wife was barren, then the children of the concubine, those children would be the heirs. So there was some legitimacy to it. It wasn't, even though it wasn't the way that God had set marriage up to look like and be, this was a widely accepted thing. Still, not a great practice for a Levite to participate in. Even if it was accepted for the time, just because something's accepted, that doesn't mean that that's how we should act as God's people, right? So let's keep on reading here. And it says, but in verse 2, it says, but she was unfaithful to him, and she left him and went back to her parents' home in Bethlehem, Judah. And after she had been there for 4 months, her husband went to her to persuade her to return. And he had with him his servant and 2 donkeys. And she took him into her parents' home. And when her father saw him, he gladly welcomed him. His father-in-law, the woman's father, prevailed on him to stay, and so he remained with them 3 days, eating and drinking and sleeping there. So we see here that he wants his concubine back. So after 4 months, he goes to get her. And it's in your translation might say that he spoke kindly to her, he persuaded her. The point is he tried to convince her to come home. He spends some time here with the father-in-law, with her family. And, from what it appears to be, the father-in-law seems to be a very hospitable man. He seems to be very generous and wanting to show him, generosity and hospitality. In verse 5, it says that on the fourth day, they got up early to be prepared to leave. But the woman's father said to her son-in-law, refresh yourself with something to eat, then you can go. So the two of them sat down to eat and to drink. And afterwards, the woman's father said, please stay tonight and enjoy yourself. And when the man got up to go, his father-in-law persuaded him. So he stayed there another night. And on the morning of the fifth day, when he rose to go, the woman's father said, refresh yourself. Wait till afternoon. And so the two of them ate together. And then when the man with his concubine and his servant got up to leave, his father-in-law, the woman's father, said, now look, it's almost evening. Spend the night here. The day is nearly over. Stay and enjoy yourselves. Early tomorrow morning, you can get up and be on your way home. But unwilling to stay another night, the man left and went towards Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with his 2 saddled donkeys and his concubine. So we see here, he stays with the family 5 days, this Levite does. And, it's one of those things where I've got family members like this. There's I don't know if you guys do, but there's always family members that they're just so nice. They're always wanting you to stick around longer. They always want you to hang out longer, no matter how you have to kind of like basically pry them off your arm to get out of the house. And that's kind of the imagery we see here from her family. They seem to be very very nice people. Now Jerusalem, the city we'll see referred to as Jerusalem, it won't actually be occupied by Israelites. It's not going to really even be called Jerusalem until the time of David. So at the time, right now, it's inhabited by Gentiles. It's not a place that the Israelites are dwelling in, and that's why it has a different name. The Levite here, they're approaching here with his concubine, his servant, and his 2 saddled donkeys. In verse 11, it says, and when they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone, and the servant said to his master, come, let's stop at the city of the Jebusites and spend the night. And his master said, no, we won't go into any city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Geba. He added, come, let's try to reach Geba or Ramah and spend the night in one of those places. And so they went on, and the sun set as they neared Geba in Benjamin. And there they stopped to spend the night. And they went and sat in the city square, but no one took them in for the night. Now, these areas, we're talking about from Bethlehem and Judah to Geba, we're talking about a span of around 8 miles is what this distance would have been. And for a man with a wife, 2 donkeys saddled up with provisions, and a servant, they're probably not moving very fast. The human normally walks about 3 miles an hour, maybe two. So this, they probably were on the road for 3 or 4 hours or so making this trek. That's a long time to walk. It's a long time to even ride a donkey or ride a horse. You're going to be pretty tired and exhausted after 3 or 4 hours of riding. And so they want to keep going because, as the Levite says, he doesn't want to stop in a Gentile city. He doesn't want to stop somewhere that's not inhabited by Israelites, that's not among his own people. And that makes sense. There's a certain element where that kind of makes sense. You know that you want to avoid foreign cities that might be less protected or that might not be the safest places to go. You feel safer around your own people, which is actually what makes what happens next so ironic. But we see here the mentality of the Levite was to get somewhere among his own people, to get somewhere that would be safer. But no hospitality gets shown to him. So let's pick up a reading here in verse 16. It says, that evening, an old man from the hill country of Ephraim, who was living in Geba, the inhabitants of the place were Benjamites, came in from the work in the fields. And when he looked and he saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, "Where are you going and where did you come from?" And he answered, "We're on our way from Bethlehem in Judah to a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim where I live. And I've been to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord. But no one has taken me in for the night. We have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves and your servant and me, the woman and the young man with us. We don't need anything. You are welcome at my house," the old man said. "Let me supply whatever you need. Only don't spend the night in the square." And so he took him into the house and fed his donkeys. And after they had washed their feet, they had something to eat and drink. It was customary in the ancient world and during ancient times when you were visiting or passing through a town, if you were going to spend the night there, you would go to the town square, to the center of the town. And presumably somebody that lived there would approach you and introduce themselves and get to know you a little bit. And they would put you up for the night. They would tell you to come back to their place. They didn't have hotels, you know, and motels back then. So this was just a customary practice that would have been commonplace. And so they go expecting to do this. But notice most people are not even hospitable enough to even do that, except for this one guy. And this guy, he's not even from here. He's here working, you know, he's moved here for work, but he's not originally from here. But he gets to know them, and then he invites them to come back to his place. And initially, the Levite says, "Look, like, we don't even need anything. We've got everything we need. You know, we're self-sufficient. We just need a roof over our heads." But this guy is gracious enough to say, no, we'll take care of you. We'll provide for you. You know, come, you know, we'll give you food. We'll take care of you." So again, it shows hospitality on this man that took them in. And so that's what we see here. Let's keep on reading here. And it says in verse 22, and says, while they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house, pounding on the door. They shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him." The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this outrageous thing. Look, here's my virgin daughter, and here is his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But as for this man, don't do such an outrageous thing." But the men would not listen to him. And so the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night. And at dawn, they let her go. Now, that is a terrible, horrific event. And it may sound familiar because we've seen something very similar happen before in Scripture, haven't we?
Sodom.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to turn back over to Genesis, and I want to kind of look at that account really quick because the similarities are just too, they're just so similar. Over in Genesis 19, we see the account of Sodom and Gomorrah and how it will end up being destroyed. In chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "And the two angels arrived in Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gateway of the city, and when he saw them, he got up to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. 'My lords,' he said, 'please turn aside to your servant's house. We can wash your feet and spend the night, and then you go on your way early in the morning.' 'No,' they answered, 'we will spend the night in the square. But he insisted so strongly that they did go with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them, baking bread without yeast, and they ate. And before they had gone to bed, all the men from every part of the city of Sodom, both young and old, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, 'Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us so that we can have sex with them.' And Lot went outside to meet them and shut the door behind him and said, 'No, my friends, don't do this wicked thing. Look, I have two daughters who have never slept with a man. Let me bring them out to you And you can do with what you like with them, but don't do anything to these men, for they have come under my protection of my roof. Get out of the way, they replied. This fellow came here as a foreigner, and now he wants to play the judge. We'll treat you worse than them. And they kept bringing pressure on Lot and moved forward to break down the door. So we see a very strikingly similar account here. And it's just sad and it's tragic. With Sodom and Gomorrah, we saw a people, you know, they were heathens. They were pagans in a sense that they had rejected God and God's teachings that had been passed down from Noah's descendants. They were going to do whatever they wanted to do. They forsook God's ways. They did whatever seemed right to them, and it led to homosexuality, a lack of decency and hospitality, and it led to violence. Now, here with God's people, with the Israelites, with the tribe of Benjamin, we see the exact same thing playing out. We see people that had forsaken God's ways. They were not paying attention to the law that they were supposed to follow. They were not paying attention to what God's commands for them were. They were choosing to do what seemed right to them in their eyes. And what was it leading to? Homosexuality, a lack of decency and hospitality, and violence. They weren't just wanting to have gay relations with these men. They wanted to rape them. There's violence as well as homosexuality mixed in here. It's vile and it's terrible. But it's the same thing we see happening right now today in our society. What are people doing? They've forsaken God. They're not listening to what God's will and what God's word teaches. They are doing whatever seems right to them, whatever makes sense to them, whatever seems right in their own eyes. That's what we see people doing today, living your own truth. Okay? And it's leading to what? Homosexuality becoming commonplace. It's leading to a lack of decency and hospitality among people, and it's leading to increase of violence. People are people. We don't change. Humanity has always been humanity. Since the fall, nothing has changed as far as the human condition goes. And that's why it's so important that we stay true to God's word, because without it, we're going to go down this dark path. It just keeps happening over and over again throughout society. And to be honest, it's really a sign of God's grace that he has tolerated it in this cycle for so long. Because you know he hates it. He doesn't like seeing people treat each other like this. But he out of love and out of perseverance and patience, he has not destroyed the world again. He wants people to do better. And that's a testament to God's love and to God's grace that he puts up with us. Yeah.
You know, you were talking earlier, about the ancient scribes and the writers and the scholars and stuff like that wanted to change terms and means and names to kind of revise history. And we see that today also. Just go back a couple of three summers, it's amazing the amount of damage that nonviolent protesters did. And yet that's how they were portrayed. We get cities burned, and so it's exactly like what you say. I mean, people have not changed. I mean, you can call something whatever you want to try to dress it up a little bit, whatever it might be. But it's still the fact that you've got to go to such lengths to try to dress it up and freshen it up and make it look prettier. It still doesn't change the fact that it's ugly.
That's right.
And so, I mean, people have not changed.
The other thing, generation here, they did not know the law of Moses. And the authorities, the rulers, the neighbor, whoever, did not know God's authority, because those men were the dead. They have been executed. And that's what we need to realize. When someone does something that calls for a death penalty, it needs to be carried out. Number one, to keep them from doing this again. Number two, to be made an example that you do these things, there is consequences for God's law. Now, our country today doesn't really, they think they value life, but they don't value the life of the innocent. And this is what's happened to this country right here. She had no choice in the matter. And if justice had been carried out before, she would live.
Yeah. And, and to that point, that's a good point right there. And the thing is there's something else to this as well. You know, the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them. The Levite threw her to the wolves. After tracking her down and spending a week in her father's house and sharing in his hospitality, when it came time to make a decision on what to do, the Levite threw her outside with these monsters. He let them have her. He didn't have to, but he chose to. And it's just it's sickening. It really is. The in verse 27 here it says, and when her master got up in the morning. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Verse 26, it says, and at daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight. And when her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine, fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. And he said to her, get up, let's go. But there was no answer. Then the woman put her on his donkey and set out for home. So there's another point to be made here, too, in the full context of what's going on here. Homosexuality, and I really want to strive this point because this is it's become so prevalent in our society. It is not an alternative lifestyle. It's sexual perversion. And I think we need to get a lot more comfortable calling it out because it is rampant in our society. And it leads throughout history. You can see it over and over again in cultures that have embraced homosexuality. It leads to other evils, including child abuse, grooming, rape, violence. And it's something people take pride in, which is what makes it even more sickening, that they take pride in something that causes so much wickedness, that causes so much evil. All of the abuse and confusion that we see today with the whole gender subject that you see in our culture, people self-mutilating themselves. You see kids being put on hormone blockers. You see the sexual explicit books that are being put in school libraries that are really meant to groom kids. All-age drag shows, that's another thing that's on the rise right now around cities. I want to make it clear, all of those things that we see in our culture right now in 2023, it all started when homosexuality was normalized in our culture. And that wasn't very long ago. It all stemmed from that. It's all a growth from homosexuality being normalized. Because without homosexuality being normalized, none of those things could have happened. Those are the next steps. Okay? And this is why this is such a relevant point. In the early 2000s, same-sex civil unions were normalized. That's when they became common. That was 20 years ago. We're talking a very short period of time for us to fall so far from what was once just normal and traditional lifestyles that everyone just accepted as generally understood as normal. In 2013, you see DOMA was ruled unconstitutional, the Defense of Marriage Act. 2015, we see same-sex marriage, gay marriage being legalized by the courts. All of that happened in a 20-year span. And from 2015, when gay marriage is legalized, to now, which is not even a decade, it's just under a decade, now you see all of that other stuff I mentioned. It is a slippery slope. And every step of the way, conservatives or Christians or whoever we wanted to talk about was saying, this is not good. And everyone laughed at us and said, no, you're making a big deal about nothing. No, it's not going to get that far. And look where we're at. And it's the same thing we see in the book of Judges with the Israelites. They accepted bad, evil behaviors of the people that lived around them, and it leads them into a very dark place where they don't know up from down anymore. And they're making just terrible decision after terrible decision. At dawn, these monsters, they let her go, and she stumbles back to the door of the house where her husband's at, and she falls down and she dies. She dies at the door of this house. And the Levite's response here is callous and cruel and just, to me, unforgivable. He says, get up, let's go. Not, are you okay? Not, I'm sorry I threw you out there with these guys. None of that. And, you know, she's been raped and abused by dozens and dozens of men continually for arguably 4, maybe 6 hours. And his only response to her is, get up, let's go. I mean, really, stop and think about that. How wicked and evil is the Levite here too? In my estimation, he's as much of a monster as the rapist. Because I'll tell you something, no one is going to violate my wife while I'm still breathing. And I'm definitely not going to throw her out of the door to save myself. That's just me. But, you know, I find this to be just so sinister, so evil that he can be so callous about this. But that's what we see. That's the attitude we see from supposed to be a priest. It's supposed to be a man of God. And it just shows you how far Israel's fallen. It's just a great example of how dark things get. It says in verse 29, so what does he do next? When he reached home, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them into all the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it was saying to one another, such a thing has never been done, seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Just imagine, we must do something, so speak up. So as if what he did wasn't bad enough, now he chops up her body and decides to use her awful death to send a political message. Because he sends these body parts out to all the different tribes to elicit a reaction. You know, there's several points we can take away from this. Number one is don't let your outrage about wickedness be too little. Don't let it be too late. Don't let it be too silent. Don't let it be too silent. Don't wait until tragedy strikes to then start speaking out against what you know to be evil and wrong. It shouldn't have to happen to you for you to start calling it out. If wrong is wrong, evil is evil, and we need to speak up about it. There was a religious man who lived during the Nazi Germany situation. You know, he lived in Germany. And, you know, I'm not saying whether or not he was like a true Christian, but he was religious. He did believe in God. He was a preacher. And he was one of the few people that had the courage to speak up and say that what Hitler was doing was evil. It was wrong. And he was arrested and put into a concentration camp. And he would later be stripped of all his clothes and hung. So, he died a very terrible way. But a quote of his was, silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. And that's very true. Your inaction is an action. And you do and you will have to answer for that with God. To be silent when evil men get away with evil deeds. Your silence is itself an action, right? We can't afford to be apathetic. We can't afford to be cowards. We got to speak up. We got to stand up for what's right. It doesn't matter if we're in the minority. Right is right and wrong is wrong. Now, maybe this priest's intentions here, maybe they were good. Maybe he thought to himself, well, something good can come out of this. But to me, it seems very disingenuous. I wouldn't chop my wife's body part. I wouldn't chop her up into pieces and use it to send a political statement. I wouldn't do that. But people seem to think that this is a way to make things happen. There is a political person in our society. His name's Rahm Emanuel. Some of you might know who he is. He was pretty popular several years ago during the Obama administration, but he was famous for saying a quote that it got a lot of uproar when he said it, but it's been true in politics probably forever. He said, you never let a serious crisis go to waste. And what I mean by that is an opportunity to do things you think you could not do before. And clearly that's exactly what this priest thought he could get out of this. Yeah, his concubine, you know, she was dead, but he could still use her to rally Israel to fight a common foe, to elicit some kind of response. And that's what he does. The people, they start talking about it. They get riled up. They want to see something done because there's this person chopped up into bits that they're getting mailed to them, essentially. In chapter 20 here, in verse 1, it says, then all of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came together as one and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. And the leader of all the people of the tribes of Israel took their places in the assembly of God's people, 400,000 men armed with swords. And the Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah. And then the Israelites said, tell us how this awful thing happened. And so the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, I and my concubine came to Gibeah and Benjamin to spend the night. And during the night, the men of Gibeah came after me, surrounded the house, intending to kill me. They raped my concubine, and she died. And I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and outrageous act in Israel. Now, all you Israelites, speak up and tell me, what have you decided to do? Now, stop right there really quick. There's a little conjecture here that I'm going to draw from this, but I don't think it's too far off. But this is my opinion. The Levite leaves out a key part of the story here, doesn't he?
Yes.
What part does he leave out?
How he acted.
how he acted. But even before that, he leaves out their homosexual tendencies, their initial desire. Their initial desire was not to kill him. It was to have sex with him. And he leaves that out of his report. To me, this is likely an indication that homosexuality was already well accepted among the people. Because if he's trying to get a reaction out of them, and he knew that they were staunchly against homosexual acts as the law of Moses taught, why not say so? But he doesn't mention that. He wants to get a reaction out of them, so he focuses on the death threats, he focuses on the rape and the murder of the girl. He leaves out the whole thing about the homosexual tendency here. That's just my thought when I read this.
A similar thing might happen in our culture too. You know, kind of going back to what you were talking about earlier. Terrible things happen in cities every day, and some of them are related to homosexual activity. But that is many times conveniently left out.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah.
And why is that? Well, it's because people are wanting to sound a sympathetic tone, but they don't want to offend anybody.
Right. And then, again, also to your point, he does leave out the part that he threw her out the door, that he let them have her. So he leaves that out as well. Still, he posts this question to them, you know, what are you going to do? In verse 8, it says, "And all the men rose up together as one, saying, 'None of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. But now this is what we'll do to Geba. We'll go up against it in the order decided by casting lots. We'll take 10 men out of every 100. From all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from 1,000, and 1,000 from 10,000 to give provisions for the army. And then when the army arrives at Geba in Benjamin, it can give them what they deserve for this outrageous act done in Israel. And so all the Israelites got together and united as one against the city. The tribes of Israel sent messengers throughout the tribes of Benjamin saying, 'What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now turn over these wicked men of Geba over to us so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel.' But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Geba to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 able young men from those living in Geba. And among all these soldiers, there were 700 select troops who were left-handed, each of them who could sling a stone at a hare and not miss." Quick point about this. Sometimes I think we don't give this its due diligence with the slings. These aren't like little rubber band guns, okay? When we're talking slings in the ancient world, these things would hurl a brock the size of a fist, okay? And they would do it at up to speeds of 150 miles an hour. That would hurt. That's a death shot right there. And in the ancient world, it's recorded that they could shoot these things up to 200 yards. So just imagine the kind of power that you would have if you had 700 soldiers that could do that and hit a hare, that not miss a hare, meaning they could hit any target they set their mind to hit. There wasn't something they were missing to be able to have that kind of force. So it's a powerful force, but they are outnumbered here. We'll pick up there next week. Thank you.